Well, this hour we'll take your phone calls with Brandon Masullo, the author of this incredible book called The Ghost Studies, very scientific look at why there are ghostly apparitions and the people who see them. We'll take your calls. We've got some more chats with him next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Brandon Masullo with us. We'll get to your calls as well as we talk about his work, the scientific work, the ghost studies. What do your colleagues say about your work, Brandon, if anything?
Most people actually, when they find out that you wrote a book about ghosts and are interested in telepathy and psi, most people will tell me a story.
They've all got one, don't they?
They do. And I was really shocked, because you kind of sit back and kind of wait when you put yourself out there publicly, but it's really been positive. You know, there's still some colleagues who'll come up to me and go, they'll tell me a story, but then they follow it up with, but you can't tell anyone or anything like that. But the response has been pretty positive. It's something that's really fascinating. And it's a mystery, and it's been intriguing for humans since, the dawn of time, this ghost stuff.
Sure.
So it's not that bizarre or out of context of anything. And listen, parapsychology is a subset of psychology. It's a legitimate discipline, just like social psychology and neuropsychology. It's an academic field. You know, the University of Edinburgh, where I studied, is a top 25 university. They were the ones that cloned the sheep in the 90s. Charles Darwin went there. And they have a whole department dedicated to studying parapsychology or paranormal phenomenon, which is, for those of us in the field, that's a great thing. It's taken seriously for a lot of people.
What's out there that has baffled you so far, Brandon, that you don't have the answers for and you wish you did?
I'll be honest with you. I think any type of poltergeist activity or recurrent spontaneous psychokinesis where objects are moving, and I really don't know what's going on in those types of cases. Do humans have the ability to move objects if they're in distress? To me, it's hard to fathom the ability of, like, with a poltergeist, we'll call it a ghost, moving objects when they can't physically touch them and things like that. I really don't know the answers to that. It's something I always read about, and I go back and forth on, well, maybe that's true, maybe that's not. But yeah, that's one that's always baffled me.
Why do ghosts seem to move our car keys?
I don't know. There's a whole book in that, George. You should get on that.
The Mischief Makers or something else. So give us another story, if you would.
Sure. I was lying awake in bed for hours. I could not fall asleep, and I could not understand why. I was very anxious and felt as if something was not right. Without warning, a soft glowing light appeared next to my bed. The light gradually morphed into the form of a man whom I recognized instantly as my ex-husband. He did not say anything and appeared to be just staring at me. What was bizarre was that I wasn't scared and I had little reaction aside from being curious. The next day I got a call from my son, my ex-husband's child, stating my ex had died the night before unexpectedly. His death occurred around the same time I saw his image in my room. I think he wanted to say goodbye one last time. So this is a case of a crisis apparition that we talked briefly about earlier. So we've all heard of these, but it illustrates the role of telepathy or psi phenomenon in apparitions. So as a man was experiencing intense emotional shifts related to the process of dying, he in a way sent a telepathic distress message to his ex-wife, who he felt linked with. In this case, the woman witnessed the typical soft glowing light, apparition, those types of things. And what's really fascinating is, since his death, we don't really know the time of his death. We know that this happened around the time of his death. We aren't sure if this is a ghost or telepathy or psi phenomenon. My suspicion is, as a person is dying in these crisis events, they're kind of in that life-threatening situation. They send something out into the environment, like a message telepathically, if you want to think about it like that, and it resonates with people who they're linked with. In this case, the wife. Maybe the son got a similar experience that night as well. But this is a great example of a crisis apparition, psi phenomenon. But it also begs that question, you know, was this, did this happen after he died, or did this happen as he was dying or before he was dying? And you can never really pin down the times to the exact moment, because obviously we don't know exactly when the guy passed away.
And you find that energy and electricity has something to do with this as well?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's one of the most common themes when it comes to paranormal or ghostly encounters, electricity. It seems to be, you know, the most prevalent things. But the idea is, I mean, listen, we all think the electricity comes from, you know, toasters and street lamps and things like that. But, you know, electricity and electrical fields comes from humans as well and animals.
Sure does.
You know, any involvement of humans also includes the involvement of electricity, because electricity is the basis for our thoughts, our emotions, our movements. We're all a collection of electrical signals.
I've heard of people who walk by street lights and the lights go out. And as they get out of range, the lights go back on again.
Yeah, exactly. So we're all sort of traveling around with our own bag of electricity. And it's just like sensitivity to environment, it's all different for everyone who's walking around in a way. So it's really important when you talk about paranormal experiences, because really the only constant in all paranormal experiences is the idea of a human being present to sort of experience an apparition, a poltergeist, an eerie feeling, a temperature change, an uneasiness, or whatever. So if a human's always present, electricity, electrical fields, magnetic fields, they're always present as well since the first ghostly encounter ever. You know, and that's an important thing to think about. You know, we're always immersed in electromagnetic fields. We can't avoid them, you know, as part of Earth. That's what it is. You know, and EMFs have always been linked. You know, there's some research saying that, you know, abnormal or fluctuating EMFs can actually cause ghostly encounters, you know, sort of trick the brain into thinking you're having a ghostly encounter. On the other side of that, there's this idea that, you know, electromagnetic fields have to do with ghosts and ghostly encounters. And, you know, every TV show and paranormal investigator team uses an EMF meter, and that's an important part of for them, indicating that a ghost is present. You know, if an EMF is moving haphazardly through the house like a person walking, the belief is obviously that that's a ghost. Whereas if you have a fluctuating EMF next to a dishwasher, you can probably say, well, that's a dishwasher.
Right.
So, you know, energy, electricity, electromagnetic fields, very, very entangled with ghostly encounters. Even when I hear these real-life ghostly encounters, some people will say, you know, it felt like, you know, my hair was standing up, or the room felt energized, or it felt like a electricity in the air, or, you know, I reached towards the apparition and my hand felt like it was shot. You know, those types of things are always common as well.
Let's go to Jason in St. Albans, Missouri, to get things started. Hey, Jace, go ahead.
Morning, George.
Hi.
Yeah, Brian, question. Do you believe that spirits hide in walls and listen and watch what we're saying and doing?
Do they hide in walls and peer in on us, Brandon?
You know, I don't think so. You know, and this is obviously just my opinion. There's no way to definitely prove this. But I don't see ghosts as sort of hanging around all day watching us. You know, like a TV. I see the ghostly encounters and paranormal experiences happening at certain times and certain events for certain reasons, like the Halloween thing we talked about before. There's some sort of need for that interaction. And sometimes when people have interactions where there isn't a need, it's more people sort of, like we talked about, linking up to the environment and having an experience of some kind. You know, there's that intelligent haunting that's sort of like the cream of the crop. You know, those types of things are harder to explain, and sometimes that falls into an earthbound spirit. But I don't necessarily think they hang around in the walls and kind of watch us and wait. You know, just like when we walk into a haunted building, it's not like a zoo where we have to, you know, call out for the ghosts to come out and, you know, try to encourage them or instigate them by yelling at them. You know, it doesn't, to me, it doesn't work like that. There's so many complex processes that happen, whether it's the person, the environment, the resonating, the frequencies, all the stuff we talked about earlier, that just simply yelling, ghosts come out, is not sufficient enough, in my view. I think there's a lot more that goes into it.
We've got Keith in Rochester, New York. Hey, Keith, go ahead.
Yes, I'd like to ask about possible early imprintings on the brain that might explain to an extent why people see ghosts. Like others, I've seen film of the baby condor chicks being fed by humans with hand puppets made to look like the mother, so when returned to the wild, the chicks know to key in on a mother condor. You mentioned the widower who was searching for the pumpkin and his wife appeared and then was gone. I've never had any experience like that, but the closest I've had over the many years, I'm now 63, I will rub my eyes in various ways, and all different kinds of figures will appear before me, figures that, again, bringing up imprinting, I would not think would have occurred within me, different figures and all different kinds of actions, some of them quite grotesque, and I'm sure that those are not ghosts by definition, but just kind of bringing this together in closing, what about imprintings that, like with the widower, seeing his wife saying, look, in the back of the garage, can people be so emotionally attached, admittedly like a husband to his wife, that he would see his wife, whereas the rest of us would not, and maybe I in my life would see things that the rest of you would not?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's a tough one to answer. I think that, you know, it's a little bit with the widower that you were talking about. It's a little bit like he's resonating with something in the environment. That's why he's seeing his wife. He's not seeing Abraham Lincoln or whoever else. So it's specific to him. There's sort of a connection to him. You know, as we're driving down the street in our cars, there's radio signals all around us. But if I tune my radio station to 92.5, I only pick up 92.5. Because we're matching frequencies. So with the husband and wife, with daughter and mother, they match frequencies, and that's when these sort of experiences happen. As far as an imprint goes, if I'm understanding the way you're describing it, there is, I mean, Carl Jung had this idea of collective unconscious. So we're all born with these archetypes and these sort of blueprints for how to really manage life. So we're sort of imprinted with these archetypes and with sort of ancestral beliefs that are common throughout every culture that's happening. So this could be me here in Ohio or, you know, people in other countries. We all have similar sort of visions and stories and things like that. So I think we're all imprinted in a grand gesture. But it could be more specific for cultures. It could be more specific for families could be imprinted with certain information. So you pass that down to your family. So it could be more micro than macro when it comes to this collective archetypes that are out there. So I think there is something to the imprint. I couldn't answer your question definitely, but that's sort of my best guess at it.
Does religion kind of change our views about these apparitions and ghostly encounters?
Yeah, I think it changes our views, and it basically changes our perception of an experience. So, you know, you could have someone who's a devout religious person have the same experience as someone who's not. The religious person might perceive that as more of a, like we talked about earlier, a demon or an angel, mm-hmm. or a sign from God or a sign from a deceased person that they loved. Whereas a person who doesn't have that religious tilt to it might experience it as simply, you know, an experience or a mundane thing or ambiguous stimuli. So everyone's past sort of influences how we perceive any sort of paranormal phenomenon. And that's what we talked about before. You know, the believers are automatically going to go to whatever they believe in. And if they believe in earthbound spirits, everything is an earthbound spirit. So I think perception, religion, they play a huge part in how we perceive ghostly encounters and paranormal phenomena.
Have you ever witnessed an exorcism?
No, I've never witnessed that.
Would you like to? As long
yes.
as it's not yours.
Yeah, right. You know, someone, I did an interview a while back, and I can't remember what I said, but I was kind of like, yeah, I'd love to have an experience like that. And then someone emails me and says, careful what you wish for, those types of things.
Yeah, exactly.
So I don't wish to be part of an exorcist, but scientifically, or with my fascination, I'd love to sort of be part and sort of gain some information from that or knowledge.
I am very curious about exorcisms and, you know, how they can get this demon, this apparent demon, out of the person's system and, you know, be gone. And it's really weird and remarkable at the same time.
Yeah, yeah. But my brain always goes to there's so much misinformation and mismanagement of things like that and possibly fraud that I'd have to be there to experience it for me to go, okay, yeah, I believe that.
Let's go to Sally in North Dakota. Hi, Sally. Go ahead.
Well, hi.
Hi there.
You know, I mean, I'm just going to talk about a serious car wreck.
What happened?
That my daughter, Kristen, you know, and she was out on the lake just having a blast. And she came home with a sunburn. And my husband and I came home early from a bike rally. And he had paid her $20 to mow the lawn.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a pretty big lawn. And he says, well, she got her money, you know, kind of sarcastic. And she just cried. And I touched her sunburned body. And I said, Chrissy, just get it done. It's going to be okay. And then I had to go to work. And Pete, her stepfather, laid down on the couch. And, well, that's the last I saw of her.
Then what happened? She got into a car?
She got into her car. It was a Cordoba, which she always felt like was a big car. And then her boyfriend was there, and he threw...
Who was driving the car, Sally? She was?
She was driving the car, George. And she didn't wear her seatbelt.
Ah, I'm sorry to hear that.
And so, you know, these two kids were, 18, 19 years old. And they were kind of competitive.
Well, and let me ask you this, though, Sally. Are you getting visitations from her now?
I have, George. I have.
And does...
Phone rings, and there's nobody there.
Strange phone numbers, no doubt, on caller ID.
Right.
So you think she's trying to communicate with you?
I do. I feel that. I really feel it.
You may be right. Let's get Brandon's take on that when we come back in just a moment. Brandon, remember this story, and let's just get your reaction to that, because I do think loved ones, during moments of tragedy like that, do try to make an effort to come back and communicate. That does happen. We'll be back in a moment with final calls on Coast to Coast AM. Well, we've got an official YouTube channel that you can watch some incredible videos. As a matter of fact, some new ones coming up pretty soon. Lex is working on that now. How do you find it? Well, two ways. One, you can look at the top of our website, coasttocoastam.com, and look at the YouTube icon, and it's free to subscribe, so go ahead and do that. Or when you're at YouTube, just type in the search engine, Coast to Coast AM Official. You got to do it like that. Coast to Coast AM Official, and then you'll go right to our YouTube channel, and I hope you really enjoy it. And welcome back to Coast, George Story, along with Brandon Masullo and his book, of course, called The Ghost Studies. And Brandon, we're going to go back to Sally in just a moment here. Sally in North Dakota has a situation where her daughter died sadly in a car crash but she's getting visitation. Sally, how often are these visitations occurring? She's not there anymore. Okay. Well, I'll get your reaction to that, Brandon. What do you think's going on?
Well, that's actually becoming more and more common, and I've heard more and more stories about this in the last 10 years. But this idea that, you know, somehow ghosts are utilizing electrical equipment to communicate. So that's like phones, texts, emails, these types of things. You know, typically people will report they'll get hang-ups from a family member's number who's been deceased for whether it's 5 days or 5 years. Then they'll get text messages from them, you know, after their death, or, you know, these types of things. And there's a book out there that a parapsychologist, Dr. Callum Cooper, wrote called Telephone Calls from the Dead, which he encompasses a great, he lists a bunch of these phenomena that are happening. And then there's Phantom Messages, which just recently came out as well, which goes over this as well. It's hard to really know. To me, I mean, listen, the idea that ghosts or consciousness or whatever you want to call it is utilizing electrical equipment has been going on for a while. So, you know, to know the exact how that's happening, I'm not sure. But anytime, we talked about this numerous times today, anytime there's some sort of trauma or crisis or life-threatening event like she was talking about, it increases the probability of these types of things happening. So we the only thing we can do is try to see these consistencies or similarities and then try to find answers as best we can from the back end.
How do you change a skeptic's mind, Brandon? Can you?
I think you could put some doubt and education in there about what could possibly be happening. It's challenging because, you know, at this point, ghosts aren't measurable phenomenon. And the paranormal is difficult to study in a sort of a logical, scientific way. And this is mainly because paranormal experiences are, you know, they're erratic, they're episodic, they're poorly documented, they're random, and they're not repeatable at will, which is essentially is everything that the scientific method hates. So these things are tough. And that's kind of why most people go towards fraud or mental illness or imagination. You know,
is that a cop out though, to be able to just to say that?
I think it's a cop out would be an easy answer to it. Right. So the idea is if I'm presented with something that I don't know the answer to, rather than spend hours and hours of researching it, I can just say, well, the person's misunderstanding or it's fraud or it's overactive imagination. And then I could go on living my life in my normal views, and it doesn't blow my mind in any kind of way. So it's an easy way to sort of give an answer to something that, you know, is pretty mind-blowing phenomenon. But, you know, there's all this stuff out there that some people point to as evidence, like pictures and EVPs. But there's really no follow-up after that. And then those things nowadays are easily faked. I think really, and this is kind of what I tell people out in with paranormal investigators, is you got to, it's about collecting data. It's about sample sizes. It's about being consistent in what you do. And that's how you progress or advance a field. You know, similar questionnaires that all these people are using when they do investigations, similar methods. You know, if sample size is huge in academia and with skeptics as well, is that, you know, if you have a sample size of 300 people, that's pretty impressive. If you give questionnaires, if every paranormal team gave a questionnaire to somebody and they did 100 investigations a year and there's, you know, I don't know, 300 paranormal teams out there, your sample size is getting pretty big. And then academia takes notice because you have 100,000 questionnaires that are just waiting to be analyzed, and then you start getting some variables or some similarities and consistencies, and then you have measurable phenomenon. So, you know, it's hard to argue with someone who has a closed mind, but if you can just push them towards a piece of research or a book or something like that, and maybe they pick it up, then that helps, you know. And that goes for the opposite end, too, with people who are just adamant believers. There's things you can push them more towards the middle with, which is, to me, the best place to be.
Let's go to Tom, truck driving in Pennsylvania. Hi, Tom. Go ahead.
Hi. How are you?
Great, Tom. Thank you.
Hey, I want to talk to you guys. I'm a long-time listener, first-time caller, so bear with me a little bit.
Sure.
A ghost story I have. Back in 1974, 1975, I was 10 or 11 years old, and we moved from Binghamton, New York, to a small farmhouse in upstate New York. And I woke up in the middle of the night, and I don't know why, but there was a man standing there, and he was a ghost. But the weird thing about it is he was in a Spanish military uniform.
Hmm.
And I'll never forget it. I closed my eyes, opened it back up. He turned to look at me like, you see me? I slapped myself a couple of times, pinched myself. We weren't studying it in school or anything like that. I closed my eyes again really hard, opened them up, and he was right in my face. And then I closed my eyes again, and he was standing back, you know, against the wall, and he turned to look at me and kind of smiled, but he was funny, and then just walked through the wall.
Whoa. Did the uniform look like it might have been from the 1800s or something like that, Tom?
Late 1800s to early 1900s. He had the ruffles on his shoulders, and the helmet was like, not a spike, but I don't know, that curved thing that they had, you know? And he had a mustache. It was a male.
Was there any kind of battle in that area a long time ago?
I don't think so. In upstate New York, in a farming community, in an old farmhouse, what the heck is the Spanish guy doing there? I don't know. It's just, I've never had another experience with anything in my whole life. Again, and I'm 54 now.
All right, let's bring the expert in. Brandon, what's a Spanish soldier from the 1800s doing there?
This is a fascinating story, and these are the stories that really get me the most excited about this phenomenon, right? So how could there be a ghost of something that shouldn't be there, right? So if you have a house for 150 years and there's no tragedy happening, and all of a sudden there's a Civil War ghost that appears there, right? And this house is in Montana where there shouldn't be Civil War ghosts. Why is that? Well, I think, and I go over it, I have a whole chapter devoted sort of to this in my book. You know, to me, it's not so much location specific when it comes to a lot of these hauntings that happen. So let's go back to our telepathic distress messages, right? So I'm in Ohio, and I get into a car accident and end up dying. I send a telepathic distress message to my brother in Montana, and he wakes up in the middle of the night, sees an apparition of me in my clothes while I'm driving or whatever, and I say, goodbye, I love you. Now, the apparition didn't happen where I died. It happened in Montana where my brother was living, right?
Exactly.
So let's say we skip ahead 150 years into the future. Someone buys my brother's house, and no tragedy happened there. Nobody dies. It was a great place to live for all those years. They walk into a room, and they see an apparition of me. And they go, what the heck is going on here? Now, the apparition of me isn't because I died in my brother's house. It's the endpoint of my telepathic distress call to my brother that he's picking up on. So in the case that the caller's talking about, maybe there was someone that lived in that farmhouse who had a cousin or a family member or perhaps even a husband who was battling in the Spanish army. And as he was dying, he sent this telepathic message that showed up in the form of an apparition to this woman in the New York farmhouse. So now the caller is picking up on this distress message. So it doesn't have to be, the haunting isn't really an imprint or a tragedy that happens in a location. It could also be the endpoint of this telepathic distress signal that we talk about. So you can have apparitions in places where there's no tragedy, there's nothing like that, there's no Spanish soldiers, there's no Civil War soldiers, but you could still have these types of apparitions. And I think that's really one of the most fascinating things that I go over in the book, because a lot of people have these experiences, and then people kind of go, well, no one died there that did that, so you must be mistaken, or maybe somebody was traveling through, or this or that. So I hope that helps them sort of get a better idea of what could be happening in that situation.
Let's go to Chris in Columbus, Ohio. Hi, Chris. Go ahead.
Hi, George. Since your guest there has been in Ohio, northeastern part,
yeah,
I've got to ask, I believe you did a show from there, the Mansfield Reformatory.
Yep, we sure did.
And every time I go there, there's something, it's electricity. And if I could, I'd like to share a love ghost story with you.
Sure.
Okay, my mother, I'm full-blooded Cherokee, I've called him quite a few times, follow a red elk. But anyway, my father died, and 3 months later, my mom, she's really depressed. Didn't know how things were going to work out, you know, with two kids. And just before daylight, she woke up. My father was there. He came in her bedroom, sit down on her bed. Mom sit up. He hugged her, kissed her, and said, honey, everything is going to be all right. But it's beautiful. The strongest power of everything is love. And I just wanted to share that with you.
Ah, that was sweet. So these sometimes these ghost stories are just emotional as well, aren't they, Brandon?
Yeah, yeah. You know, I mentioned a little bit before. These aren't negative experiences for the most part. In the accounts that I go over with these people I've met over the years, you know, 60-some percent I think are more positive than they are negative. And it's this idea of someone coming back saying goodbye. Saying, you know, it's okay. You know, these are positive experiences, and they're life-changing, and they reaffirm the connectedness that you had with this loved one. And these are important things, and like we talked about before, it could heal some sort of psychological wounds and help you move through the grief process. So this phenomenon could be used as a coping skill, and there's a lot of research out there that says that sometimes paranormal experiences are used as coping skills. So, you know, I always shudder when it's always negative, 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 ghost, 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 scary, scary, scary,
right,
scary, scary.
Right.
It's not like that in real life.
Let's go to Joe in the Bronx. Hi, Joseph. Go ahead.
Hey, George. How are you?
Yeah, Joe.
Good. Brandon, yeah, I wanted to ask you a question, then maybe relay a story about a full apparition that I've seen. The question is, do you think that there is a subliminal underchannel of communication going on between the ghostly apparition and the recipient of the ghost experience? Maybe perhaps subconsciously there's the subliminal communication, two-way communication going on that precipitates the ghostly apparition appearing. And I had a full apparition experience after my brother passed away. I'm a singer-songwriter, and I was having writer's block on a song. And I've relayed this story before on Coast to Coast. My brother comes into the room. He looks the way he did when he passed away in the hospital, sort of. It's during the day. At the foot of my bed, he walks by. And he speaks to me and says, just get it done, and then disappears into the wall. Now, can you maybe elaborate on what could have precipitated this?
Did your brother pass away, or he was?
Yeah, this was after he passed away.
How long ago did he pass away? Before he had the experience.
Maybe 14 years.
Okay, all right. Well, I'll answer your second question, then we'll get back to the first question real quick. So I think it's kind of similar to what we talked about earlier, you know, with the husband seeing his wife, and then the wife kind of says, hey, check behind the workbench, and he finds the pumpkin there. This is this idea where you sort of gather information from the environment, possibly connecting or resonating with his consciousness, and a communication is happening. In other words, he's saying, get on with it. Complete your song, those types of things. He's giving you the motivation because that's something you need at that point. Just like that guy needed to find that pumpkin, you needed some motivation. So you resonate with the consciousness of your brother, and when you resonate with something, it's not just information, it's visual stuff as well. And the idea you talked about before as far as that unconscious communication between people, there's a lot of cases out there like that. There's one case in my book that I go over where a guy wakes up in the middle of the night, and he has this feeling like his dog is in trouble, and he has this visual apparition of a dog, you know, laying in the water and injured, and he can't communicate with the dog, but he could somehow feel like the dog is trying to communicate with him, and they're kind of reading each other's emotions, and then he, you know, wakes up, goes finds the dog, and that type of thing. So, you know, while there isn't physical communication or words, there's some sort of, like, understanding or telepathy or reading of minds type thing.
Where do we get the book, The Ghost Studies, Brandon?
The Ghost Studies is available at Barnes & Noble. It's at Amazon.com. If you like listening to books on radio or in your car, you can get it at Audible as well. So basically anywhere you can find books, you can pick up the
Ghost. Super. Brandon, thank you. Love talking to you. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasor, Stephanie Smith, Chris Burrows, Tim Banal, and George Knapp, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.